The jury has come back with a guilty conviction in the Corey Jones case. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. In 2015, Jones, a musician, was stranded near the highway. Then, former Miami Gardens officer Newman Raja arrived in plain clothes. Shortly thereafter, Jones was shot dead. Now Raja faces life in prison. Also, mental illness holds a lot of stigma. Jessie Close, sister to actress Glenn Close, has battled with mental illness most of her life. She's in South Florida to talk about her fight to get rid of that stigma and help people find treatment. And there's a community of Key West residents known as liveaboards. They live on boats. Photographer Mark Eden has a photo exhibit of some of these people. Finally, how do we get young people into jazz? Grammy Award-winning jazz musician Robert Glasper has some ideas. He's playing the Arts Center this Friday. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the jury in the case of Corey Jones' death took 5 hours in deliberations. They convicted former Palm Beach Gardens police officer Newman Raja with armed manslaughter and first-degree attempted murder for the October 2015 shooting death of Corey Jones. Now, my apologies, in the billboard you heard Miami Gardens, it is Palm Beach Gardens. This is the first time in decades an active duty officer in South Florida has been brought up on charges. This is Jones's father, Clinton, speaking to the media after the jury's verdict with a message to Newman Raja.
You had the opportunity to let him go, but you decided to do something else, and you took his life.
Raja's sentencing is set for April 26. Joining us now is Daphne Durrett. She's the reporter for the Palm Beach Post covering this story. Daphne, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is a historic moment. We even heard the story on NPR's national news, but take us to that moment when the verdict came down.
Well, the verdict came as a surprise. The timing of the verdict came as a surprise to a lot of people because the jurors had gone home the previous evening at about 5 o'clock and they returned to continue their deliberations at 8 a.m. And they had only been deliberating for about half an hour before they told the judge that there was a verdict. So a lot of the family members of Corey Jones and some other people were scrambling to get there just to be in court for when the verdict was read. And so when the verdict was read, the judge had already warned everyone not to be emotional. So there were some tears from Jones's family, but everyone was very stoic. Newman Raja himself had no outward reaction. The deputies handcuffed him shortly afterwards and took him to a holding cell, and his defense attorney, Richard Lubin, went with him. And shortly after that, court was adjourned.
Remind the listeners of some of the key facts in this case. What were the circumstances in which Raja encountered Jones?
So Corey Jones was a building manager for the Delray Beach Housing Authority, but he was also a drummer. He played drums in a number of churches in South Florida, but he was also part of a reggae band called Future Presidents. And Future Presidents had a gig north of Palm Beach Gardens in Jupiter shortly before Jones's encounter with Raja. He was on his way home. His car broke down. He pulled into the off-ramp of Interstate 95 and was calling for a tow truck when Newman Raja, who was working a burglary detail, drove an unmarked van up the wrong way of the exit ramp, got out of the car in plain clothes. Newman Raja says he approached Corey Jones and identified him as a police officer and that Jones pulled a gun on him. Well, the audio recording from Jones's roadside assistance call did not capture any such introduction that Raja made, only that he asked Corey Jones if he was good several times before he yelled at him to get his hands up, and then the shooting started.
And this is part of what the prosecutors say about the discrepancies in Raja's statement, what was on tape and what he said actually happened. He claims that he had introduced himself as a police officer, but that wasn't on tape?
No, that recording wasn't on tape, although the defense called an expert that said that there may have been some sound 6 seconds before Corey Jones is heard on the recording saying, "Huh?" They said that there may have been a sound that was him introducing himself as a police officer, but by his own statements to investigators after the shooting, he said Corey Jones told him, "I'm good, I'm okay," before he even said, "Hey, I'm a police officer." And that was not captured in the roadside assistance call. And, the prosecutors think that that was a key piece of evidence that led to the jury's decision.
We heard from Corey Jones's father after the verdict, but what else have you heard from the family?
Well, I think the theme in everything that the family members are saying is that they are a Christian family, and they are praying for Newman Raja and for his family. They have said to a person that none of them take any pleasure in or joy in the fact that Newman Raja is going to prison and is going to be separated for his from his family for a number of years. And all of them told me that they continue to pray for him and his family. And but the thing that they've said is that justice is justice, and that because their loved one died, that there needed to be some atonement on his part.
I'm talking with Daphne Durrett, reporter for the Palm Beach Post. Former Palm Beach Gardens police officer Newman Raja was convicted of manslaughter and first-degree attempted murder this morning in the shooting death of Corey Jones. It's the first time in decades that an active duty officer has been brought up on charges. Daphne, what have you heard about from law enforcement? Again, considering that this is the first time in almost more than a quarter of a century that a cop on active duty is brought up on charges, what is law enforcement's reaction?
Well, we did get a reaction and a statement from the head of the local police union here in Palm Beach County, and I'm just paraphrasing what his statement said, but he said basically that it's a sad day in law enforcement when someone will be sent to prison for essentially defending himself against someone who pulled a gun on him. So that has been the defense's stance from the beginning, is that none of this would not have happened had not Corey Jones been armed that night. And I think that's where they're sticking with, even in spite of the jury's verdict. They are saying that this was this all could have been prevented if Corey Jones did not have a gun.
And so, but basically, I mean, law enforcement, again, the first conviction, in Florida in all that time. Did they say anything about, again, how the, law enforcement may be viewed by the courts, going forward if there's any other kind of shooting?
No, we didn't get any statement along those lines. I know just speaking to, over the, I've covered this case for the past, 3.5 years since it happened. And I know that there have been several groups that have talked about law enforcement and changes that need to, that they feel that need to be made in terms of how law enforcement deals with members of the public. I know also that Corey Jones's family members have been vocal about wanting to help with those efforts. So that's, I know that there has been some conversation about that, but I think in the moment today, the verdict is really raw, and I think those kind of conversations are the kinds of conversations that we may see in the coming weeks.
Now, again, as you said, Raja is in custody. The sentencing is set for April. What is he facing? Does he have an appeal?
So, because he was convicted on the armed manslaughter and first degree attempted murder charge, he faces a minimum of 25 years in prison. And the attempted murder charge is what gets him there because he will have to serve, based on the first degree attempted murder conviction, a 25 year day for day sentence. But the judge could sentence him to up to life in prison. And as far as appeals, we haven't heard from the defense yet what exactly they will appeal. My guess, just from watching the trial, would be a major avenue for their appeal will be the fact that the judge kept them from calling more than one medical examiner witness. They wanted to call three expert witnesses to refute the state medical examiner's claims that Corey Jones could not have run very far after he received the fatal shot. And that's a significant piece of evidence in the case because Corey Jones's body was found 41 yards away from his gun.
Again, talking with Daphne Durrett, reporter for the Palm Beach Post, covering the story, the verdict of former Palm Beach Gardens police officer Newman Raja, found guilty in the shooting death of Corey Jones. That happened this morning. Daphne, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to look at a community of Key West residents who live on their boats, and they like it that way. That's all coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. So what does it mean to live on the hook? Some Key Westers can tell you all about that. They're nicknamed the liveaboards. Their boats are their homes, and they usually don't pay rent. Last year, longtime Key West photographer Mark Eden was awarded the Knight's Art Grant, and he decided to capture the world of those who live their lives anchored just off the island. His exhibit is called On the Hook, and it'll feature some of the black and white portraits he shot over the past year. Tonight is the opening reception, by the way, at the studios of Key West in Key West, starting at 6 p.m. He's joining us now from the WLRN studios in the Southernmost Bureau. And by the way, just to disclose, Mark is married to WLRN reporter Nan Klinginer. Mark, great to have you on the show.
How you doing, Lewis?
All right, tell us, real quickly, how do you define what it means to live on the hook?
Well, yeah, it's pretty much, we're an island, we're surrounded by water, and there's always been a boat community off the edge of Key West. I mean, as long as there's been a Key West, there's been people living on boats around it. And it's, you know, it's one of the, it comes down to, you know, one of the big issues in Key West is affordable housing, and it's definitely that. But it's also kind of a more adventurous way to live for a lot of people.
Do we know how many people are living like this?
I don't know if there is a survey out there. And, you know, it changed. I mean, this community was hit pretty hard by Hurricane Irma. And a lot of those boats sunk. And so people have been kind of scrambling to get back out there or making other living arrangements. But, you know, there's probably about 500 boats around Key West.
Now, the project was funded as part of a Knights Foundation Arts Grant. But was this a story that you've been wanting to tell for a long time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been working on this. I mean, I've been wanting to do it for a couple of years, but you know, it's not a it's not the kind of show you can sell pictures of to tourists. So the Knight Grant, the Knight Foundation grant was just kind of crucial for that, and it gave me the support. I've been working on this project for 10 months now, and I wouldn't be able to do it without that.
You know what I find interesting? I mean, reading about this is, I mean, and I'd imagine it just seems common sense that part of it is because they love the privacy, right? So. How did you approach them? How did you convince them to let you, you know, turn your camera on them?
Well, pretty carefully. This is Florida, you know, land of stand your ground, and I'm not sure totally how that applies on water. I went up pretty carefully, and at some point I realized you can actually knock on people's boats, but that took me a couple months to figure out. And mostly I would go around from boat to boat and look for people on deck and strike up a conversation with them and eventually ask if I could take their picture, and 95% of them said yes.
No, wait, hold on.
Yeah, I mean, it can seem like a forbidden community, but it's not.
Hold on, knock on boats. Please help me understand how you do that.
You kind of drive your boat very slowly up to their boat, and you knock on their hull, you know, and hope they hear it or their dog hears it.
Did you ever have, anybody who kind of just said, you know, yell at you, not off my yard, get out of my yard, but get off my boat or get away from me?
No one was ever really hostile about it, but there, you know, there's one guy, I'm like, can I take your picture? And he's like, sure. And then he just sunk down below deck. And I was like, so no picture? And he's like, my ex-wife hates me. She's from New Jersey. And it was kind of a non sequitur, but I respected it.
All right. So let's talk about some of the folks that you did get. You photographed a mother and daughter who live on a boat. And the daughter actually, right, she's spent her whole life on it.
Right. And that happens to a lot of kids down here. And I've known a bunch of kids who have grown up that way. And, you know, They tend to be very well-adjusted kids that you can throw into any situation and they'll do fine. But that's Pascal and Lalani. And Pascal is a Montessori teacher down here, which, I mean, in a small town, that's kind of like being a celebrity. And, you know, she spent 20 years out there raising her daughter. And her parents aren't together anymore, but Lalani's father also lives out on the hook on a different boat.
And what prompted, well, you know, going back to the mom, what prompted her to do this, to have that kind of lifestyle?
It was straight up affordability for her. You know, Key West is, you know, it's Manhattan rates for real estate and it's hard to earn that kind of money. So, I mean, it's the way a lot of people make it, but it is, you know, it's also just absolutely beautiful out there.
Well, I mean, yeah, let's go to that real quickly though. I mean, how many of the people you ran into, is it because of the affordability and it's just cheaper to live on a boat?
Yeah. I mean, some people that affordability is necessity. Some people are, you know, by inclination, not wanting to spend that money on rent, you know, seeing it on, you know, the opportunity to travel or things like that. There's a woman I photographed named Satya, who works as, you know, she works at Blue Heaven, one of the great restaurants in Key West. And, you know, her whole thing is she wants to be able to be able to travel when she's ready. And so she's got this boat, she's got it all fixed up and she's kind of just looking for the next port eventually.
And so then one of the other things too, cause I was trying to understand it, you know, being able to live rent free, there are rules on where you could park your boat. Help us understand, like, where are these folks actually, like, where they park their boats, where are they living?
Well, some of them are dictated by the military, some of them are dictated by private property, and some of them are dictated by nature because, you know, you have to, you know, the boat's got to be deep enough, the water's got to be deep enough that your boat's not going to drag or, you know, run aground when the tide goes down. But if it's too deep, you know, you're subject to pretty big tidal flow. So there's that. And, you know, everyone, there's a long place called Fleming Key, which is attached to Key West, and it's a big Navy base. It's an ammo dump. And people just tend to periodically creep their boats up close to it. And then the Navy has to go out and basically brush everybody back and get them to re-anchor further out.
And then
but the people who, you know, but it's safer to be closer to the island. So therefore, the people who have longevity out there tend to be the ones who are closer to the island.
And then, of course, when weather, I'd imagine, I mean, when weather, Mother Nature starts to get nasty, then what?
Well, they hunker down and, you know, everyone's biggest fear is a neighbor with a poorly tied boat or poorly anchored boat. I mean, that's like everyone I talk to, that's what they worry about. And there's one couple I talked to and I shot them, you know, early on in the project and I stopped by a couple weeks ago and I was like, hey, you guys acquired another boat. But the boat had broken free and they couldn't find the owner and it turned out the owner had been deported to Australia.
Mm.
So, you know, but that's, you know, they managed to get control of this boat. But, you know, if a boat breaks free in an anchorage, it kind of, you know, pinballs around and can do a lot of damage to other boats.
Right. I'm talking with Key West photographer and resident Mark Hedden. He was awarded the Knight's Art Grant in 2018, and he spent the last year capturing the lives and stories of residents in Key West who live on boats. His exhibit, On the Hook, has the grand opening tonight in Key West at the studios of Key West starting at 6 p.m. And if you want to see some of Mark's photos, go to our Instagram at WLRN. These are really fascinating. They really are. You know, Mark, some of the some boats are now being used in the Keys, as you know, as Airbnbs. And I wonder, how do these folks, the liveaboards, feel about that reality?
Well, it's a mix because, you know, it's a way to get up a leg up in the world. You know, it's a way to buy into Key West and start making money same way people do with real estate, but with a lower buy-in. But it's also a lot of those people come out, you know, a lot of people come out and be guests on Airbnbs and they don't know how to handle themselves on a boat if they get into trouble, which mean the liveaboards who surround them end up having to save them, which can be, I think, tedious and time consuming and frustrating for them.
Has it happened a lot?
I think so. I mean, I don't, you know, it's hard to have data on it, but I mean, I know one guy out there who's got 7 boats that he runs as an Airbnb, like a hotel, and he's got a housekeeping station floating.
Wow.
So, you know, it's kind of, you know, you see these kind of same like architectures of like a hotel, except it's just all out there with detached boats in a same zone.
And then, so life for these folks, I mean, basically you're close enough to land and you're going to come to land. Maybe it's to work or just to get the basic necessities, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and the thing is everybody who lives out there, everything that goes back and forth to their boat has to be hauled on a dinghy.
And how do city officials feel about it?
I think they're okay with it. I mean, law enforcement tends to come down pretty hard on the liveaboard community, and I don't necessarily know that that's fair, if that makes sense. I mean, there's bad elements in every neighborhood, so judging a whole community by some of the bad stuff that happens doesn't totally seem fair. But Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? During the time that you were, you said you had wanted to work on this story for a while. And so I'm mm-hmm. wondering, when's the first time, because you've lived in Key West for a long time, when's the first time that you actually met a liveaboard and you even started thinking about this idea? Like, oh, that's an interesting story. Who are these people?
I mean, my first boss down here was a liveaboard.
Really?
Yeah. And I mean, I brought up Blue Heaven before the restaurant, but the people who started Blue Heaven were able to do it because, 25 years ago, because they were living on a boat and saving money. And that's how they kind of got their footing and made their way as a business. And, it's almost like, up north, it's a neighborhood, you drive by all the time and never really go into. And then one day you drive into it and you're like, wow, this is kind of cool.
I want to come back to Hurricane Trail quickly because, after Irma, I'm wondering, after Hurricane Irma, what happened to these residents? Are they all still there? Did some of them leave?
Some of them left. I mean, there's also a whole community. I mean, a lot of people lost their boats, kind of found other housing for a while, and then found new boats. And that's happened over the last year. And I actually didn't want to start shooting immediately in the aftermath of the hurricane because I wanted people to have a little time to rebuild. But I talked to people who had their boat, disappear right after the storm, and then they found it, 3 weeks later, 20 miles up the road, and managed to get it off the mud and get it all cleaned up, and they're back living on it.
Yeah.
But there's also, there's a place called Wisteria Island, which is partly in this project, but I actually also partly not. But it's in legal dispute as to who owns it, whether it's the federal government or a family. And while it's in legal dispute, it's kind of it's a little bit of a no man's land, so it's home for a lot of people. There's all sorts of camps out there and everything where people are making their way.
And does the county, does the state help these owners? Like after the storm, homeowners get assistance in some cases. Do these liveaboards get assistance?
I'm not sure if the state does. FEMA, a lot of these people got money out of FEMA after the storm, and that's kind of how they got their boat up into the marina and get it fixed and things like that. I'm not sure if the state has done a lot. And, there are mooring fields out there, too, which are a little more regulated than being purely on the hook, and it's a debate about whether people in mooring fields are living on the hook. The other big thing is sanitation out there. So there is a pump out boat that goes around and pumps out people's bilge tanks.
Wow. Real quickly, what was your favorite shot of the bunch?
What was my favorite shot of the bunch? It's wrong. I pretty much asked everybody in this project for permission to shoot him, except I've got one guy going across the harbor in a dinghy giving me the finger. And for some reason, that is just the photo I like most of all. And I know it's wrong, but I do.
There's nothing wrong with that. That's always a fun one.
I grew up in New Jersey and went to a lot of punk shows, so it kind of feels like home to me.
There you go. Again, talking with Key West photographer Mark Hedden. His exhibit is called On the Hook. And it has the grand opening tonight at the Key West, at the studios of Key West, starting at 6:00. And again, we've got some of those photos on our Instagram at WLRN. Mark, congratulations and thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis. I appreciate it.
All right. Still to come, fighting the stigma of mental illness. We're going to hear from the sister of actress Glenn Close about her personal struggle and her activism. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Mental illness affects millions of Americans every day. According to the National Alliance on Mental Health, 1 in 5 people between the ages of 13 and 18 will have or do have a mental illness. Now, the stigma surrounding mental illness very often prevents those struggling with it from seeking the treatment they need. It's the idea of admitting something is wrong. It's the fear people have that they're going to be judged. Jessie Close is focused on changing that narrative. She's struggled with bipolar disorder since she was a child, and she's dealt with substance abuse and alcoholism. When her son was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, a form of schizophrenia, she knew she had to get involved in activism. In partnership with her sister, Glenn Close, the Academy Award-nominated actress, Jessie is now an ambassador for the nonprofit organization Bring Change to Mind. They've launched a series of television PSAs bringing awareness to that issue of the stigma. Jessie's sharing her story this weekend at the Key Clubhouse of South Florida, and we've got information about that on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Jessie joins us now. It is such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
You're very welcome.
You know, Jesse, I wanted to go back and looking at your story, this goes back to your adolescence, and you were struggling with depression and having manic episodes very early on. When did you get the self-awareness as to something isn't right?
Probably not until I was in my 40s, and I couldn't help but focus on the path of destruction that I left behind me.
You know, at reading your story, you were raised in this very unique situation. I mean, your parents were part of a cult, took you around the world. Who was your support system growing up?
Oh, probably my sisters and my brother.
Mm-hmm. And what was your relationship like with your siblings?
Good, very good, Mike. But the problem with our family, though, is that we weren't all together all the time like a regular family. So I would spend time with one or the other. I remember Glenn would take me on when I wasn't in school, and I would just follow her to backstage, and you know, it was interesting and fun. I love to sit backstage, and I would draw. Drawing was one of my outlets. Mm-hmm. Just like writing and photography. So
you said it wasn't until you were in your 40s. So then throughout your life, as you're dealing with different things, what did you think was happening to you? Did you talk to anybody about it?
No. Our family just did not go to psychiatrists. They just thought that I was wild, which I was. And I don't think I showed them, or they didn't see the depth of depression and despair that I would fall into. But when I had children, it became much more evident that something was wrong.
And you bring this up in your book Resilience, and you detail the many ways in which your mental illness impacted your life: struggle with drugs, relationships, multiple marriages, and then there was a story of the attempted suicide.
Yeah,
and that changed things for you. What happened there?
Which attempt are you?
Well, there was the one where you there was a gun in the house, but then you thought, this is going to impact the kids in a horrible way. Oh, I can't do this to them.
Right, exactly. There was my husband at the time had a revolver that he kept. We lived out in the middle of nowhere in Montana, in a tiny little place called McAllister. And he always kept that handgun in a little lock box in his truck. But we had come home that evening, and I noticed that he did not lock it up. And I was obviously not okay. All three of my children were home. And in the middle of the night, I got up and I went out to the truck, and I could see the revolver through the window, and I put my hand on the door handle to open the door to get it. And suddenly I saw the scenario. I realized that a gunshot would wake everybody up, and what a horrible scene they would have seen. And I just couldn't do it. My devotion to my children really saved my life that time.
And is that when everything started to change for you, as the way how you were viewing what you were dealing with?
Not right away. I didn't get to a hospital until I was 50, And but what that did do is if that kicked me into realizing that I thought it was because of alcohol. So I did start going to AA, and I just celebrated 18 years sober. Yay! And
Congratulations.
thanks. And so that was one thing out of the way, but I was still obviously bipolar. But that didn't really enter into things right away because everything was focused on getting sober and staying sober and,
Yeah. Yeah,
so.
definitely. And again, congratulations on that. Again,
Thanks.
definitely. Talking with Jessie Close, she advocates for mental health awareness and combating the stigma surrounding mental illness as an ambassador for Bring Change to Mind. The organization was started by her sister, Glenn Close. Jessie will be in Miami this weekend, again, speaking at the Key Clubhouse of South Florida. Now, Jessie, your son struggles with mental illness. Help us understand what schizoaffective disorder is and how it manifests itself.
Schizoaffective disorder is very much like schizophrenia, and he started getting really sick when he was in boarding school, and he was sent home. The headmaster said that he thought he was suicidal. He was sent home, and he was struggling. And he would say and do bizarre things. He, at one point, was just sitting and rocking back and forth. And a friend of mine came over who had studied psychology in college, and she said, Jess, I think he has schizophrenia, but why don't you leave the room and I'll talk to him? And he finally admitted to her that the people walking past our home were spying on him. Everything, I mean, it was psychosis to the nth degree. At one point, he was going to commit suicide, but he had to find the portal first, and the portal was a psychotic vision of another world. If you've never been around someone who is psychotic, it's scary and damaging. And he would come in to our home and just stand and stare at me. And his eyes were so terrifying. When he was finally lucid again with the help of medication and being in the hospital, he said, Mom, you thought that I was thinking malevolent thoughts when I would stand there and stare at you, but actually, I was so terrified that I couldn't move. And that is kind of in a nutshell what a lot of people with serious mental illness, the noise inside your head, because I've also been psychotic, is so loud that it's almost impossible to be part of this world. It's a very, very powerful brain disease, and he is amazing right now. He's almost 38. He's an accomplished oil painter. He's been married for 8 years. The transformation is absolutely amazing.
And I wondered too, is at what point in your life, because this, this is why you're coming down here,
It's to, it's not just to share the stories, but it's to talk to people and let them know that there is help. There's places to get treatment, you know, but also it's that fighting that stigma. When did activism become important to you?
Oh, gosh. Since I was a teenager.
But on this issue, though.
On this issue.
Yeah.
When did it become important?
Yeah.
Tell me again.
Yeah. When did wanting to speak up about this issue and help others deal with it, when did that become important to you?
Oh, gosh. When he first went to the hospital, I would practice telling people that my son had a mental illness, and I would see their eyes would kind of dull, and I could see that they were thinking things that they were scared.
Yeah.
People are scared of mental illness, and for good reason too. Sometimes it's I would certainly encourage anyone and everyone to study mental health, mental illness. If you have it in your family, get help. We hear horrible things all the time, and a lot of the mentally ill community get blamed for things that are not their fault.
The
access we have to mental health is deplorable. If you don't have money, you cannot get a really good hospital stay.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many people out there that need help. Go ahead.
It is an interesting thing to think about, and something important to think about too as we move forward. And again, you're going to be here in Miami at the Key Clubhouse of South Florida this weekend. We have information up on Facebook and social media, WLRN Sundial. Again, Jesse Close, ambassador for Bring Change to Mind. Again, the organization started by her sister, Glenn Close. Again, trying to fight that stigma and help people in finding treatment. Jesse, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate you sharing your story. And
thank you.
And a lot of people looking forward to seeing you and hearing from you this weekend.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate it. All right, still to come, jazz performer Robert Glasper wants you to think about jazz in a different way, and he'll explain that coming up next. Back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Can't help but just feel relaxed when I hear that. Pianist Robert Glasper has been on the forefront of jazz music for years. His collaborations with leading hip-hop and R&B musicians, as well as his eclectic genre-bending approach to music, has garnered him 3 Grammys and many more nominations. Glasper brings his talents along with a super group of jazz musicians to the Arch Center this Friday, and he's going to be playing tracks from his newest album called R&R Equals Now, or Reflect and Respond Equals Now. Now, prior to Friday night's show, the musicians will be performing for a group of high school students as part of the Arch Center's Jazz Roots program, which brings hundreds of high schoolers from Miami-Dade Public Schools to see live jazz for free. And Glasper joins me now in studio. Great to have you here, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You know, I'm curious as to how you're trying to inspire young people to that next generation to get into jazz. I mean, you think about it, jazz music is supposed to be rebellious.
Right.
It would be perfect for young people, but
100%.
Okay. Is it challenging to get them involved, to get them to love it?
Not for me, because I give them something that they can gravitate to. I give them something that they can understand. You know what I mean? I play music of my generation, so I'm going to attract people of my generation. Right. Just the same way John Coltrane did, same way Miles Davis did. In the 30s and 40s and 50s, they were playing songs that were hip, cutting edge, and sometimes looked frowned upon at the time. You know, My Favorite Things was not a jazz song. You know what I mean?
Right.
In their mind, that was hip. That was from a Broadway tune. So we're going to incorporate that. And just, you know, so I'm doing the same thing. I mean, actually, I was talking to somebody out there just now. I'm actually in the tradition by doing that, you know, by incorporating things of now into the music, because the music is a mutt to begin with. You know what I mean? It was made from different styles, you know?
What is it? I don't know if you run into people who ever tell you, like, jazz, but that's kind of like what my parents used to listen to, smooth jazz, and I just don't want to listen to that.
Exactly. All the time.
What do you tell? I mean, you want people to think about jazz differently.
I want them to think about it just like it's living. It's now, because a lot of people want to close the book on it and say it's dead and kind of look at it as something that's in the museum. You know what I mean?
Right.
And a lot of jazz purists are like that, you know, like, you know.
Well, when did you start getting into it? When did you start playing, but also when were you into it?
I was into it in elementary school, actually, because my mother was into it. So luckily I had a parent that was really into the music, you know, and she was a singer and a piano player. And so, you know, some of her gigs during the week were at restaurants playing standards and singing standards and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So I would come home and you never know if she was going to have on the radio. It could be, you know, Ella Fitzgerald. It could be, you know, it could be Whitney Houston. It could be, you know, Marvin Gaye, or it could be Bette Midler, or, you know, it was her, the music she listened to.
That's
was
a
so
wide range.
Super wide range of people. You know what I mean?
You, thinking about your, you know, early on in your career and your professional career, you've had the opportunity to work with a lot of talented people. I mean, when you think about it, but I'm curious about the collaboration process for you. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
For me, I like to bring in elements, the elements that people love from the other artists, mix with the elements that people love from me, and just see what happens. You know what I mean? A lot of people, when they collaborate, they try to kind of take over the whole thing.
Right. I'm thinking creative people are just going to sometimes clash.
Yeah, exactly. So when I collaborate with somebody, I don't bring them in and say, I need you to do this, and it has to look like this and blah, 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 because then you're not adding that other, what makes that other person special into the equation. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I like to add what I bring, add what the other person brings, and that's what's going to be unique. That's going to be something that's probably never been there before. You know what I mean? You know, so that's what I try to do when I collaborate with people.
And how do you get past the ego? Because again, when you're dealing with big name artists.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
I don't deal with artists that have egos. I bypass those people.
Okay.
I've come into contact with a few. Actually, when I ask someone to do something, I already know their vibe already. You know, even if I don't know them personally, I've seen interviews or I know people who know them.
Yeah.
And those people who know them know me. And I've had people say, yeah, that person's talented, but they're kind of like this to work with. Or, you know what I mean? Like they're, so and those are people I trust, so I'll stand clear of those kind of people. But for the most part, everybody that I collaborate with are open and very, very inclusive people and want to create something different, you know?
You know, looking at your new album, Reflect plus Respond Equal Now, the message is very current to the times. How is your music a response to the divisive politics of the days we're living in?
Well, what I did on this album was I'm not much of a talker on my records. So I try to, if I can't, because sometimes when you're a musician, some things get lost in translation when you might have a protest piece, but people don't realize it's a protest piece because they just hear instruments. So they're not that tapped into the instrument. So a lot of times I have spoken word on the album. Right. And have people talking. So like on this particular album, I have my friend Amanda Seals on there, and she did a piece basically about women empowerment, you know what I mean, and how important it is. I feel like there's a big movement happening that right now, you know, with women getting equal rights and things that should have been in line a long time ago, but they're not. So that's one of the things I want to put on the album, and I wanted to be clear with it. So I had her say a spoken word piece so you hear it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Not just like, oh, mm-hmm. Here's a piece and it's piano trio. I'm speaking through the piano. Like, nah, people aren't going to hear that. Everybody's going to get that message. So I got to be clear with certain things, you know? So that was one of the ways I do it. And I do that on a few of my albums. I have people speak about certain things. And I think that works a lot better sometimes than everybody doesn't want to hear a whole speech, you know, but people listen to music all the time, you know? And so if you can put some positivity and things inside of a song, it's kind of like crushing the aspirin in the orange juice, you know, when you give it to, you know what I mean? When you give it to your kid or something like that, it's like they're taking the medicine. They don't realize it, but they're taking it.
They're taking it. All right. That's an interesting way. I didn't think of it that way. All right. Talking to pianist and jazz performer Robert Glasper. He's at the Arts Center this Friday.
Yes.
And you can learn more about that show and his latest album at WLRN Sundial. What are some of the pathways when you talk to young people? What are some of the pathways for success that you tell them if they're passionate about music? You know, how do you tell them, all right, here's how it really works and what to expect?
Right. I tell people all the time, if you really want to be a real artist, you have to be true to yourself. You know what I mean? And not feel like you have to conform to what's popular necessarily, you know?
But can you do that? And when you think about, you know, what's popular, though, is what's going to help you make it, right?
Yes. But you can't lose your voice when doing that.
Okay.
So that's the thing. You can be current and be popular without losing your voice. A lot of people lose their voice and they literally sound like everyone else. So sometimes people play me something and I'll say, okay, let's have a real conversation.
Yeah.
What makes this different than what we hear every day? Point to what makes you unique. Like this song you played me, why am I supposed to now go play it for all my friends? And they'll kind of be like, I mean, you have nothing to say. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Does your voice really sound that different? Are you playing anything that different? Are you, you know, so there's a way you can be true to yourself but still be current.
You went to a prestigious school.
Yes, I went to the High School for Performing and Visual Arts in Houston.
Do you have to do that to give yourself a good chance to make it as a musician?
No, you don't have to do that at all. I know most musicians didn't go to schools like that because most schools like that don't exist. There's not many. You know what I mean? There aren't many. And some of the ones that do exist, it's hard to get into, or either you don't live in the right area code, you know what I mean, whatever, you know, stuff like that. Technically, I didn't live in the right area code to go to that school, but my mother, one of the bars she played jazz at, whenever I would go with my stepdad to pick her up, she would make me play the last song with her.
Yeah.
And the bartender was like, whoa, he's really good. I know the director at the High School for the Performing Arts. He should go audition. So I auditioned, and they gave me a fake address so I can go there.
I love that. Okay, all right. You can always tell the story afterwards.
Yeah,
after the fact.
Exactly.
You know what? You get to spend some time with high school students as part of this Arts Center's Jazz Roots program.
Yep.
What is it you want to give them mostly?
Inspiration and a different outlook on things. I was just talking about this. The reason I think I'm sitting in this chair is because when I was in high school, I saw Roy Hargrove. He came to my high school and did a performance. And I've never seen anybody that looked like me on stage that dressed like me.
Yeah, because he did. This is interesting. I read about you. It's like he wouldn't come up in a suit.
Yeah, no. He came up in Timberlands, overalls, jeans, you know, baseball cap. You know, he looked like me. So when you see yourself and you want to be with what you see, you know what I'm saying? You see that inspires you. Most other jazz musicians look like my principal. You know what I mean? I didn't want to, that's not inspiring me. You know what I mean? Like I saw Roy Hargrove and I was like, wow, I could dress like that. And it feels like that young and everything and still play jazz. I didn't know that. I had never seen that before. You know what I mean? So I feel like when I see students and everything, I want to give them that same opportunity to be like, oh snap, you know, because most jazz musicians aren't doing that. You know what I mean? So it's different.
And yeah, I wonder like what's the one question you get most from young people when they come up to you? After they've heard you, they've seen you, they've watched you, what do they ask most?
They always ask about the different stars I play with.
Oh, geez.
Oh my God, how's Erykah Badu? You know, how's this person? Because the reality is, when they meet other jazz musicians, those jazz musicians don't have those stories.
Right.
They don't have they have stories of playing with other jazz musicians that kids don't care about for the most part. You know what I mean? But people come up to me and be like, oh my God, how is it working with Kendrick Lamar? How is it working with, you know, people that they know? That's the connect I was talking about. So not only am I connecting musically with them, but even just in pop culture, I'm here now. In pop culture, and that's what's missing in the jazz world, is being present in pop culture now as well. We're out of that conversation. You know what I mean?
I don't care about you performing with them. I enjoyed having this conversation with you.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Jazz performer and pianist Robert Glasper performing at the Arts Center this Friday. Again, we've been playing tracks from his newest album called R plus R equals Now, Reflect and Respond equals Now. Now, again, prior to Friday night's show, the musicians will be performing for a group of high school students as part of the Arts Center's Jazz Roots program.
Oh, yeah.
Learn more about all this at our website, WLRN.org, or our Facebook. Robert, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
So good. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. That's our program for this Thursday, March 7th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a great weekend. Talk to you again on Monday. Na, 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 na.